Welcome to the Beyond the Pearls podcast, based on the Morning Report series from Elsevier. This podcast has been adapted for audio in collaboration with series editor Dr. Raj Dasgupta, as well as the volume editor for each book. Each episode features an in-depth case dissection format and aims to deliver practical, concise, and easy-to-digest information. And now, here's today's episode.
Hi, Dr. Raj here, and let's talk about the third section of hypersomnia. What are we going to be discussing today? We're going to talk about the evaluation and diagnosis of narcolepsy and idiopathic hypersomnia. So, you know, I think the most important thing is let's start off with narcolepsy. And while we're talking about that evaluation, I'm going to give you all the details and pearls about how to work up idiopathic hypersomnia at the same time. So the first thing I would do when I do suspect narcolepsy, why their patients are going to have complaints of excessive daytime sleepiness, I'll suspect recurrent accessory symptoms, that I do suspect it. So the first thing is always getting a nice sleep history, doing a good physical examination, see if they have features of obstructive sleep apnea. And when we talk about, you know, excessive daytime sleepiness, of course, one of the most important things to evaluate is insufficient sleep syndrome. How do we do that? Well, we could do some sleep diaries. We could do some sleep logs. We like to do that for at least 2 weeks. Then we could combine that with actigraphy. You know, actigraphy rhymes with the word activity. It's going to be finding out the truth behind someone's sleep patterns. But the problem is, it's just not clinically practical in most cases. But if you do get actigraphy, it's always wonderful to get that, you know, for 2 weeks, you know, while they're doing their sleep logs to really make sure that you're just not missing, you know, insufficient sleep syndrome. So history and physical, sleep logs and diaries, plus or minus actigraphy. Then, of course, getting baselines, so subjective tests of sleepiness. I mean, one of the classic ones we use is the Epworth Sleepiness Scale score, but there are other tests also that are used for evaluation of sleepiness, just to mention two others. There's the Stanford test, there's the Karolinska Sleepiness Scale score. These are other things we could use to help establish that baseline and also may consider repeating it after they're on therapy. So the fourth bullet point is polysomnography. So we need polysomnography, you know, in the sense that if we're going to pursue something called a mean sleep latency testing, MSLT, that you want to get the PSG first. But the main reason why we do this PSG, beyond that being part of this protocol and to ensure enough sleep prior to the MSLT, is to exclude things like obstructive sleep apnea. That's going to be one of the most important things that we want to exclude first. I also put periodic limb disorder, but OSA is going to be the main thing we want to exclude. And now when we talk about making the diagnosis, you can include some of the data from the PSG, which happens the night before, in the overall workup. You could include sleep onset REM periods, which I put over here. So we'll kind of piece it all together. But yes, you want to do a PSG, and that's going to lead to an MSLT, mean sleep latency testing. And this is going to be very important. We're going to dive deep into how do we perform the test, but the mean sleep onset latency, if we're talking about diagnosing narcolepsy, is going to be less than 8 minutes, and you need to have 2 sleep onset REM periods. And remember, you can include the data from the PSG, which is going to happen the night before you do the MSLT in the morning. If you do find things such as obstructive sleep apnea on the PSG, well, you're not going to pursue the MSLT. If you don't sleep at least 6 hours, you're not going to pursue the MSLT. So we're going to assume that if they're going to pursue the MSLT in the morning, that the PSG met the criteria and it was essentially unremarkable. Another important thing to mention on boards and in clinical practice is doing a drug screening prior to doing the sleep testing. And another test, which is not used for the evaluation of narcolepsy, but used to evaluate response to therapy, is something called the MWT, the Maintenance of Wakefulness Testing. And we'll talk about that. But You're going to do studies to see if the patient can actually stay up. And, you know, you want to make sure that their mean sleep onset latency is going to be greater than 40 minutes. You don't want them to sleep during this test. But MWT is more for the evaluation of therapy that you're using someone, that you're treating someone with narcolepsy. But when we were talking about making the diagnosis, it's everything here on the left, the history, the sleep logs, plus or minus actigraphy, getting baseline subjective tests of sleepiness, doing a PSG, and a mean sleep latency testing. So what are going to be some of the limitations of an MSLT? So it's very important to note that the MSLT is not valid as a diagnostic test in children that are less than 6 years of age. That's going to be very, very important. And I can just imagine just practically it would be very hard to do in children less than 6 years of age. The second bullet point is that normal and abnormal sleep latencies have not been established outside the usual testing hours of 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. So we have a very specific protocol. This is going to be very important because if you have individuals that have circadian rhythm sleep disorders, it's going to be very hard to interpret if you don't have that set time where the study was validated for. Also, the third bullet point is the MSLT is sensitive to sleep deprivation, meaning that if you're going to be sleep deprived, then you do the MSLT in the morning. Of course, you're going to fall asleep during the study. You're going to fall asleep during the naps. And on top of that, it's possible to even have these sleep onset REM periods. So, you know, it's very sensitive to sleep deprivation, which is why it's important to get the sleep logs and sleep diary, doing the drug testing, and ensuring sleep the night before. So, and with that being said, 6 hours of nocturnal sleep required by the testing guidelines may be too little, not enough when we talk about pediatrics. Remember, we've been talking about, well, being sleep deprived, well, it depends on, well, how old are you? How much sleep time do you actually need? And, you know, when we do this testing in kids, just having 6 hours of nocturnal sleep could be significantly sleep deprived when it comes to a kid compared to an adult. So these are important limitations that you need to know about when we talk about the MSLT. Clinical history. It's important to know when you evaluate people with narcolepsy that narcolepsy with cataplexy cannot be diagnosed by history alone. This is a huge change in the American Academy of Sleep Medicine guidelines. In the, I hate saying this, olden days, when we hear or heard of a story classified for cataplexy, you could have made that diagnosis. But nowadays, we want cataplexy history by itself cannot be used. You need to actually do a PSG. These are the new AASM guidelines. You need to do a PSG followed by an MSLT is now required to confirm the diagnosis. Type 1 narcolepsy can be diagnosed also with low hypocretin levels in the CSF. And we're going to dive deeper into this. So let's talk about that CSF hypocretin 1. So CSF orexin hypocretin 1 levels less than 110, and always make sure you're looking at the units, or 1/3 of the mean normal control levels is what we would call seen diagnostic in narcolepsy type 1. So levels have to be less than 110 or 1/3 of the mean normal control values. And so they're going to be low when you have type 1 narcolepsy, which is narcolepsy with cataplexy. And you could use this for the diagnosis of type 1 narcolepsy, though it's not practically used in many, many sleep labs for the obvious reason you're performing a lumbar puncture in a child, in a young individual. So what about HLA typing? So one of the things when we're talking about, you know, causes of narcolepsy, we said genetics is playing more and more of a role. And we do know the gene that narcolepsy is associated with, which is the HLA DQB10602. So I would know that for your board exams. This is something that you could check during blood work. But what is my first bullet point is there's limited diagnostic utility about checking this. And so what is the bottom line about this is that, you know, narcolepsy type 1 is likely a T-cell mediated autoimmune disease, and it occurs in people with the HLA DQB10602 following some kind of environmental trigger, which is important because we're trying to figure out what are these environmental triggers. Could it be the infections out there? And of course, because it's going to be autoimmune, it may be associated with other autoimmune diseases. So let's take this piece of information and try to dive deeper. So a 32-year-old woman presents for a second opinion regarding long-standing excessive daytime sleepiness despite routinely sleeping 8 hours per night. She has no history of sleep paralysis, sleep-related hallucinations, or cataplexy. She brings her prior diagnostic testing for your review, which includes a HSAT, home sleep testing, which shows a apnea hypopnea index of 0.4, and HLA testing demonstrates positivity for the HLA DQB10602. You order a PSG and MSLT. In the meantime, she asks about the significance of this HLA finding. So how does HLA DQB10602 positivity relate to central disorders of hypersomnia diagnosis? This is going to be a great question for your board exams. So let's do this together. So choice A is HLA DQB10602 positivity indicates that a central disorder of hypersomnia, that's what CDH stands for, is likely present, because this finding is rare in the non-sleepy population. You know, I'm probably going to say no when you talk a lot about these genetic studies, that you can see them in people who are not hypersomnic. So I don't feel that this is going to be the right answer. How about B? HLA DQB10602 is seen with equal frequency in people with type 1 narcolepsy, type 2 narcolepsy, and idiopathic hypersomnia. I feel that you're going to see this genetic testing more in type 1s. You know, people have that low orexin hypocretin level in the CSF, less in type 2. And I think you can even see these in people with idiopathic. So I would say seeing equal frequency will make me see this is going to be the wrong answer. C, HLA DQB10602 is only seen in people with type 1 narcolepsy. I wish that was the case, you know, but no, like I mentioned earlier, I do feel you could see it not commonly, but in people with type 2 narcolepsy, you can see an IH, though it's not common. And of course, you know, you said that, you know, is it going to be, you can see it in the non-sleepy population, but it's not common at all. But let me read the last one. HLA DQB10602 can be seen in people with type 1, type 2, both narcolepsy, or idiopathic hypersomnia, but is most common in people with type 1. I feel that's going to be the right answer there. That's going to be the breakdown of what we see, you know. And once again, you know, just because you're positive doesn't mean that you're going to have a central disorder of hypersomnia, which is why A is wrong. So for me, the right answer is going to be D. So D is correct. So the HLA, otherwise known as human leukocyte antigen, you know, system or complex, is the gene complex that encodes for the proteins on the surface of white blood cells. These cell surface proteins are responsible for regulating our immune system and our ability to fight infection. The HLA gene complex resides within chromosome 6. Of course, there's always going to be things you have to memorize for your board exams. I would know chromosome 6, as well as this HLA type. And most people with type 1 narcolepsy carry the HLA DQB10602 gene. So HLA does have a limited role as a diagnostic test. You know, as I mentioned, it's present in 98% of people with hypocretin deficiency narcolepsy and nearly all people with narcolepsy with cataplexy. You know, unfortunately, it is present in 25% of non-sleepy controls. So that's why choice A was wrong. No specific association with IH, somewhat more common in type 2 narcolepsy relative to idiopathic hypersomnia. Clinical utility is largely before you pursue a lumbar puncture for hypocretin. What does this mean? If HLA testing is negative, the CSF very unlikely to show hypocretin deficiency, and as a rule out for type 1 narcolepsy in cases of atypical cataplexy. So bottom line point is that, you know, if you're going to pursue a lumbar puncture, and why are people not excited about it? It's a lumbar puncture. That's why patients are not, you know, gung-ho to do it. I don't blame them. That you could do this testing and say, hey, that if you're positive for this test, you know, then in the right clinical setting, that you're probably going to be able to clinch the diagnosis by having a low hypocretin in the CSF. If you're negative for the genetic testing, then there's pretty much no need to pursue lumbar puncture at that time. I want to say this, you know, HLA DQB10602 is an important clue to type 1 narcolepsy pathophysiology. And I mentioned this already, but I just wanted to say that type 1 narcolepsy appears to be a T cell mediated immune disease. And it occurs in people with HLA DQB10602 following an environmental trigger, resulting in the loss of hypocretin neurons. So what is the evidence behind this? Is that number one, we've seen these individuals to have low CSF hypocretin. You know, autopsy shows 90% of hypocretin cell loss. We have the HLA association. There's T cell receptor, you know, GWAS association. But these individuals, despite all this, have not met all the criteria for an autoimmune disease. And which is why it's important that even though this is probably a strong association as far as etiologies, the autoimmunity, that we still don't consider type 1 narcolepsy an autoimmune disease just yet. So let's do another question here, really focusing on the MSLT. So which of the following statements concerning the MSLT is true? So A, the mean sleep latency discriminates normal individuals from those with abnormal sleepiness. Right off the bat, the answer is going to be no. That sounds like the wrong answer. What did I say? The MSLT is very, very sensitive to people who are going to be sleep deprived. So it doesn't mean you have a central disorder just because it's positive. You know, people who are just sleep deprived could have a positive MSLT. So A seems like it's going to be the wrong answer. A mean sleep latency of greater than 10 minutes to fall asleep is considered normal. So number one is that I would say that no one should be sleeping on an MSLT per se. I mean, if you are able to get adequate sleep at nighttime and it's good quality and quantity sleep and we're not missing anything, that you shouldn't per se be sleeping at all during the MSLT, during the napping studies during the day. So just because it's greater than 10 minutes doesn't mean that it's going to be normal. C, its utility in the diagnosis of narcolepsy is mainly based on the presence of sleep onset REM periods, so REMs. That one sounds really good because, you know, when we talk about the diagnosis of narcolepsy, whether it's going to be type 1 or type 2, I mean, beyond, of course, look at the mean sleep onset latency that, you know, the cutoff is going to be less than 8, but we really are looking for these sleep onset REM periods. And we'll talk more in depth about that, but I really like C here about these sleep onset REM periods. Or D, it is indicated to help predict how sleepy an individual's ability to safely drive a motor vehicle. And I'll just say this, that's going to be the wrong answer. And there's no test out there that's going to predict, you know, that you're going to drive safely. Of course, what am I hinting at here is something called the MWT, the maintenance of wakefulness testing. But of these choices right here, which one seems to be the most correct, the true statement, it has to be C over here. That it really is those slow REM periods, sleep onset REM periods that help us in the diagnosis of narcolepsy. So where are my answer explanations? MSLT is an objective measure of the tendency to fall asleep in the absence of physiological arousal. Its main indication in clinical practice is part of the evaluation of patients with suspected narcolepsy. The utility of the MSLT in the diagnosis of narcolepsy is mainly based, it's underlined, based on the presence of SO-RAMs, which are commonly seen in people with narcolepsy. So I really want to spend some time in this table. I think this table is going to be super important when we talk about diagnosing type 1 narcolepsy, which is narcolepsy with cataplexy, type 2, narcolepsy without cataplexy, and idiopathic hypersomnia. So let's go, we're going to talk about, in this slide, their excessive daytime sleepiness. We'll talk about cataplexy, MSLT. We'll talk about what's going to be the cutoffs, how many SO-RAMs, and of course, non-MSLT diagnostic criteria. So when we talk about type 1 narcolepsy, which is narcolepsy with cataplexy, excessive daytime sleepiness, which is having daily symptoms for over 3 months, excessive daytime sleepiness having daily symptoms for more than 3 months, it's mandatory when we talk about, you know, type 1 narcolepsy. They got to have that excessive daytime sleepiness. That when we talk about cataplexy, whether it's going to be, you know, partial cataplexy, you know, the classic cataplexy that we talk about, it may be present. If the MSLT is used for diagnosis, it must be present. So why do we say that? Is that in the olden days, we'd say that if you had a classic history of cataplexy, intense emotion, or laughter inducing this muscle weakness, we used to let you diagnose type 1 narcolepsy. But now, if you have cataplexy, you must pursue a PSG and MSLT. You must. So is MSLT required for diagnosis? The answer here is no, but it's typically performed. Why is the answer here no? Is because you can do that lumbar puncture, which we'll get to in 1 second. So when you just say, must you do an MSLT to diagnose type 1 narcolepsy? The answer is no. That's a good board question right there, because you could do the lumbar puncture. So when you do the MSLT, what is the mean sleep latency in these cases? Well, the mean sleep latency is going to be less than or equal to 8 minutes. So a mean sleep latency of less than or equal to 8 minutes is going to be the cutoff when we talk about type 1 narcolepsy. How many sleep onset REM periods do you have to have to make the diagnosis is going to be 2. So mean sleep latency of less than or equal to 8 minutes plus 2 or more sleep onset REM periods is going to be very important. And are there non-MSLT diagnostic criteria? The answer is yes. You could do the low CSF hypocretin levels, which can be less than 110 or less than 1/3 of the control levels. So this is going to be how we're going to be doing the diagnosis of type 1 narcolepsy. So what about type 2? So excessive daytime sleepiness daily for more than 3 months? The answer is yes. It's mandatory. These individuals, just like type 1, or have excessive daytime sleepiness. Cataplexy may never be present in these cases. You know, if they do have cataplexy, then of course, then we're thinking about type 1 narcolepsy. Is an MSLT required for diagnosis? The answer is yes. Yes, yes, yes. Remember, for type 1s, that you can do the lumbar puncture, but for type 2s, the answer is yes. What is the mean sleep latency cutoffs? So the mean sleep latency of less than or equal to 8 minutes with 2 sleep onset periods, just exactly like the type 1, is required for the diagnosis. And are there any non-MSLT diagnostic tests? The answer is not at this point. There are none. Now, what about someone that comes in who has idiopathic hypersomnia? Once again, they got to have excessive daytime sleepiness, daily symptoms for more than 3 months, and cataplexy is never going to be present. It's not going to be present. MSLT, is it required for the diagnosis? The answer here is no, but it's typically performed. No, but it's typically performed. And we'll talk about the alternatives to diagnose idiopathic hypersomnia in a few seconds, but that's going to be an important one for the board exams. So what are going to be the cutoffs here is that a mean sleep latency onset of 8 minutes or less is going to be your cutoff, just like for type 1 and type 2 narcolepsy. But how many SO-REM periods do you need? You're going to have 0 to 1 SO-REM periods, 0 to 1. And probably the most important part for your boards, now, you know, circle this or write this down 100 times, is that what are non-MSLT diagnostic testing for idiopathic hypersomnia? Well, even though not practical, you could do a PSG with a total sleep time of greater than 660 minutes. So you really have to beg your sleep lab manager to do a very extended PSG to do this. So if you have a PSG total sleep time of greater than 660 minutes, that will clinch the diagnosis in the right clinical setting. Or 1 week actigraphy showing a 660 minute average total sleep time. Of course, it's estimated. So these are the two other tests as an alternative to doing an MSLT. Once again, the first one is a PSG with a total sleep time of greater than 660 minutes, which is not very practical in many cases. Or the second is doing 1 week actigraphy showing a 660 minute average estimated total sleep time. Still, not very practical in most cases, which is why MSLT, though not required for the diagnosis, is typically performed. So let's keep on going with this thought process. So once again, this is a continuation of the previous slide, that I do want to talk about the CSF hypocretin, ruling out other causes, and summary of the criteria. So when we talk about type 1 narcolepsy, narcolepsy with cataplexy, you know, CSF hypocretin, if measured, if you do, needs to be low, less than 110 or 1/3 of control values. Do you need to rule out other causes? The answer is, it's not mandatory. Of course, we do, we always do, but it's not mandatory. And what is going to be the summary of criteria? That it's going to be excessive daytime sleepiness with plus either A or B. What is A? A is going to be cataplexy and a mean sleep onset latency of less than or equal to 8 minutes and 2+ SO-REMs on the MSLT. Or B is a low CSF hypocretin. So this is going to be a nice summary when we talk about how do we diagnose type 1 narcolepsy. For type 2 narcolepsy, the CSF hypocretin is going to be normal. Rule out other causes is going to be necessary. And what is going to be the summary of how we diagnose type 2 narcolepsy? Excessive daytime sleepiness plus a mean sleep latency of less than or equal to 8 minutes and 2+ SO-REMs. There's no cataplexy, no hypocretin if measured, no low hypocretin if measured, and there's no other explanation. And last but not least, there's idiopathic hypersomnia. If you were to measure CSF hypocretin, it would be normal. Should you rule out other causes? The answer is yes, it's necessary in this case. And what is the summary of the diagnosis? Is excessive daytime sleepiness plus A, B, or C. So A is going to be what we historically do, mean sleep latency of less than or equal to 8 minutes plus 0 to 1 SO-REMs. B is a nighttime polysomnography with a total sleep time of greater than 660 minutes. Or C is actigraphy for 1 week with a daily total sleep time of greater than 660 minutes. No cataplexy, no hypocretin if you end up measuring it in the CSF. And there's no low hypocretin. I take it back, no low hypocretin. And there's no other explanation. And once again, I want to put this here because it's so important for your board exams, is that, you know, HLA DQB10602 can be seen in people with type 1 narcolepsy, type 2 narcolepsy, or idiopathic hypersomnia, but is most commonly seen in type 1 narcoleptics. And HLA has a very limited role as a diagnostic test, which is what we previously discussed. And with that being said, I know we spend a lot of time with this. It's so important in helping make the right diagnosis of excessive daytime sleepiness. And I'll see you in the next section.
Thank you for listening to the Beyond the Pearls podcast from Inside the Boards. This podcast is executive produced by Christopher Brightigan and Dr. Patrick Beeman. This podcast is intended for educational purposes only and is not medical advice. Ars longa, vita brevis.